and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the marketing and advertising podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Runicus.
Hi, and I'm Paul Jacobs. And today's special guest is Nick Telson. We'll be talking about the UK hospitality sector as we are emerging from lockdown again. Also, we'll talk startups, investor pitches, improving diversity and inclusion in this community, angels, successful exits, and much, much more. So, welcome, Nick, to Wax Lyrical. Thank you very much for joining us. It's great to have you here. Looking forward to this chat.
Yeah, delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Look, let's dive straight in. So, I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar with your name, Nick, because of Design My Night. For anyone that in the minority who don't know what D&M is, as you call it, Nick, it's an online platform where you discover and book nightlife, bars, pubs, restaurants, you name it, which now covers 20 cities and towns across the UK and Ireland. Something I know I've used regularly, actually, in this last week, and I think I use it more than I realise, which is something we can get onto. So, Nick, I know you successfully exited Design My Night in 2020, and we'll come back to kind of your startup and exit stories. But thinking about where we are in the world now and coming out of lockdown, kind of, I thought I'd start by asking kind of for your own reflections, given your kind of career experience on kind of the future of the UK hospitality sector post-COVID.
Yeah, I actually fully exited Design My Night Jan 2020, so right before the pandemic hit. So perfect timing from a investment point of view. But yeah, pretty heartbreaking to see what's happened to the hospitality sector since then. I've said to lots of my friends in hospitality, and I'm actually an advisor and investor on different bits of software in hospitality, that I think it will recover fully, if not more. I think, as with a lot of startups, this period, you know, the last 12, 14 months was all about survival. So like, can the pubs, can the bars survive, lock their doors and just survive? And then, you know, now we're opening up again. I think people are going to go wild. So I think people are going to flood back to restaurants, flood back to bars. I think it shows us how much we've missed it all as well. So, you know, I'm super confident in the future of hospitality. We've lost a lot along the way. I think what you'll see is actually a lot of groups now buying up cheap inventory for pubs and bars that have closed. So I think, you know, groups that maybe have, you know, 10, 15 bars might quite quickly try and buy 5, 10 more. Because, yeah, and I think this is a society as a whole. It's a bigger question. I think as humans, we will go back to normal quite quickly. And I think we are creatures of habit. And I think there will be some changes in our lifestyles, but in the main, and definitely in hospitality, I see us getting back to normal pretty quickly as and when we're allowed to.
Yeah, I've heard the future referred to as the Roaring Twenties, which really excites me. I mean, it was quite a kind of funky, slightly edgy, slightly illegal period in our history, wasn't it? Did you think we're going to go back to that? And if we are, who are going to be the winners and who are going to be the losers in our hospitality sectors?
I think, yeah, I think they're saying the Roaring Twenties in as much as it was just, you know, crazy party time. You know, everyone was out having fun. So I think we'll see a lot more outdoor stuff. And I think if that's one thing that this pandemic has showed us or will push us towards, is that London, which I know very well, is actually very poor for sort of outdoor fun. When you go to other European cities, you know, everyone's eating and drinking civilized on the streets, whereas the UK outdoor drinking scene is outside a pub, you know, 10 deep on the pavement. And actually, when we first opened up after the lockdown in the summer, I went into Soho, and actually seeing Soho pedestrianized with all the restaurants having chairs and tables on the streets was wonderful. And I was like, well, this is what Soho should always be like. So I think we're going to see a lot of that. A lot of pop-ups that are going to be outdoor, obviously. So I think they're going to be some big winners. But I just think pubs, bars, restaurants, I just think all of them, I don't think a particular sector is going to win. I just think we're all so desperate to get back out and socialize that as long as we're all within the guidelines, I just think everyone is, you know, this summer will be pretty big for hospitality.
Okay, Nick, let's jump back. You mentioned Design My Night, selling it kind of, or exiting kind of in Jan 2020, but let's go even further back in terms of how that all started. Can you share with us like your founder's story? How did it all come about with you and your co-founder, Andrew?
Yeah, so Andrew and I were and still are best friends from university. So we actually met week one, year one, and always discussed maybe doing our own thing. But we went off into the corporate world, as most people do. I went off to L'Oreal and did marketing there for 5-6 years. Andrew went over to Accenture and did, I still don't know what he really does there, but got paid a lot more than I did for doing it. And we were actually in New York visiting his then girlfriend, now wife, because she's American. So we went a week before just to have some fun together in New York. And there was a website there, which was actually about promoting cheap drinks, especially for girls. So that's quite a big thing in America. You know, if there's a group of girls, come to this bar and we'll give you free shots or whatever. So we saw that. And then at the same time, when we were speaking to the hotel concierge, he was asking us loads of questions, you know, like what type of night do you guys want? What type of venue? Have you got an idea of area? So we sort of put those two together and thought, oh, okay, well, maybe like a concierge-y style nightlife website in London. I'm from London, could be good. Then when we got back, I spoke to a very good friend of mine who works at Diageo, and she still works there actually. And I said to her, look, I've got this idea for a website. You know, is it something that Diageo would advertise on if it got big? And she said, absolutely not, because you can't promote cheap drinking. And then the drinks brand won't affiliate itself with that. Didn't think of that. So that was like our first pivot before we started. So we thought, okay, well, we won't do that. But what we will do as a sort of hook was a price comparison site for going out. And that was back in 2009. So you had like Money Supermarket, Compare the Market, the Meerkats were on the scene, I think. And no one was doing that in nightlife. So we thought, well, that would be quite cool, especially in London where the price variation is very big. So the first iteration of Design My Night was you go on, you pick your type of night, type of venue, like the concierge, but then also you pick your budget. And then we would show you venues to suit your budget. And the press hook was like the UK's first price comparison site for nightlife. So yeah, we went for it. We did it. We built it in our spare time with an agency. And we worked sort of every night after our jobs. We met up every weekend for about a year. We actually went to Andrew's Accenture office every weekend. So he signed me in as a client. And we were just in there every weekend working. And then we launched it at the end of 2009. And what we decided, which was quite novel at the time, was that I would go full time and Andrew would stay at Accenture and we'd split his salary for 6 months. So that allowed us to have some income and allowed one of us to go full time on it at least. So we did that for 6-7 months, got some traction on Design My Night, and then he went full time as well. And then that's sort of how we started the journey of Design My Night.
Be keen to hear a bit more kind of the highs and lows. Obviously your route to success, I assume, was had a few bumps along the way, but kind of what are ones that spring to mind most in terms of the highs and lows that you had through the kind of the 7 years?
Yeah, we surprisingly were quite a smooth journey. So our lead investor, who was our chairman, was the head of entrepreneurship at the London Business School as well. And so he was an older gentleman. I'm sure he won't mind saying that, but very by the book, very educational, you know, and applied that to our startup. And, you know, when we sold, he said, I've never seen a startup just follow the growth trajectory curve and forecast like you guys. So we were very fortunate that we didn't have any sort of absolute, you know, depths of despair moments. I think the founder journey ongoing is tough. So burnout is a huge part of the journey. And I became a bit obsessed with the company and would work 14-hour days, 7 days a week. You know, every time I was out for dinner with friends, I was on my phone. If I was on holiday, I was on my phone. And, you know, I did that for about 4 years. And I think that the stress of that took its toll, both emotionally and physically. So I think that was an ongoing one. Part of the business that always sticks out was the SEO side. So we built Design My Night on SEO, and that was our strategy. And when we sold, we had 8 million uniques a month, and 65% was from Google Organic. So we were a huge SEO play. And probably a few years in, where we were very naive with SEO, and we'd hired an agency to do our SEO. And back then you could do loads of, as they were called, black hat techniques. So dodgy stuff to make Google rank you higher. They've cleaned up the algorithm since then. And we had no idea what they were doing, but we came every morning, we checked our analytics, and one morning we came in and our analytics had dropped like 85%. So we literally lost pretty much all of our organic traffic. So we just thought it was an analytics error, checked it the next day, it was the same. So that was a big, oh God, what's happened moment. And then Google changed their algorithm. It was called Penguin, that change, which basically was cleaning up SEO. And it penalized any sites that were doing these black hat techniques. So we pretty much lost a year's worth of traffic and had to rebuild it all again. So we fired our agency, we learned SEO ourselves, and then did it in-house, did it all by the book, followed the rules, and built it back up again. But yeah, that probably cost us a year's worth of sort of growth in terms of the traffic. So it was a huge worrying moment. But at the same time, one of our proudest moments in the way that we dealt with it as two founders.
I'd love to talk about the exit. It's something that, you know, most founders do focus on. It's always there in the distance. So apart from the financial indications, how do you know when is the right time to walk away?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And it's something that I say to all of the founders, like I mentor now or invest in, is have a plan in place. There is no, it's a right time to sell. I think what we did was very purposeful, and we knew, and we sat down with our investors as well and said, we want to exit within 5 years of our second round of funding. So that was part one. Part two was Andrew and I, very crassly, and money is, you know, a very dirty word for some reason, sat down and thought, well, look, how much do we want to take from Design My Night each? You know, how much do we want to walk away with as founders for this last 7 years to be worthwhile, and what we want on the next part of our life? Luckily, we were very aligned on the figure. And we then took that figure and worked it back. So we were like, okay, if we're going to take, I'm going to make numbers up here, if we're going to take £10 million each, that means we own, let's say, 30% of the company each. So we need to sell Design My Night for, say, £60 million. We then looked at the industry and saw software acquisitions were going for about 10 to 18 times your profit. So we said, okay, well, let's pick 12 times, and then knew that in 5 years, our profit needed to be 60 million divided by 12. And we basically charted that course over 5 years to get to that figure. The actual exit itself took a year from engaging with a broker to signing the documents to sell it. So the only sort of point for us on shall we sell was when we were a year out of our forecast to hit that profit figure that we wanted. You've also got to look at the market. So then, you know, obviously we didn't know coronavirus was coming, but we were no longer sort of the upstart. You know, we had the big boys, OpenTable, Bookatable, rounding in on us, copying us, because we were taking their market share. And, you know, these are multi-million, billion-dollar companies. You know, they were coming for our slice of the pie. We also had a few competitors coming over from America, sort of doing the USP that we were doing. So we just felt, you know what, everything's coming together at this right time. And we were both emotionally ready to sell it. You know, we were both knackered and didn't have that grit anymore. You know, we had 100 employees and you know, you need to be on your game every day to keep the business growing at the length that we were growing it. And I think we both accepted that we weren't at that level anymore as founders. So all of those things came together to think, okay, now's the right time to try and sell.
And I think one of the less talked about consequences of an exit, it is something that's referred to as seller's remorse. Did that hit you? And if it did, you know, how did it manifest itself? And more importantly, how did you get over it?
Yeah, it's not something I've talked about a lot, but I didn't have seller's remorse that I'd sold the company. So we were ready to sell. We had fully come to terms with handing over our baby and we were very ready to hand it over. And we were very happy with the financial rewards, let's say, that we were getting for doing that. So that was actually fine. And you have we had a 2-year earnout. So we had to work with our new owners for 2 years, which is essentially like a very long handover. So you're getting to grips with stepping away. And, you know, the last 6 months, we weren't as involved in the business. What did hit me was in Jan 2020, when I woke up the next morning and thought, What do I do? Like, what's my purpose in life now? Like, I don't know what to do. Like, I would jump straight to my emails and see the cluster mess of emails that I normally had to deal with and open Slack and have 100 Slack messages to deal with. And my purpose, I started Design My Night when I was 25, was to build a company, have employees, run it how I want to run it, be financially successful. And I ticked all those boxes. So it was a very strange period for probably a week where I was really down and just like, what's my next purpose? And I know everyone that has some money says money's not important. And money is important for certain sects of happiness because, you know, the not having to worry about money is very nice position to be in, but the actual buying stuff, being able to buy stuff, is very short gratification. So I really just had to sit down and think, okay, well, what's going to make me happy? What do I want to make me happy? Yeah, and it doesn't include money, and that's going to have to be what I go on to. That's not something I'd ever really thought about before.
I like that you call out that talking about money, like, is a dirty like subject, but doesn't necessarily need to. And it's clear that it was kind of a key part for you and Andrew. How important is it? And we'll go into more detail shortly, but how important is it about making money in your next phase of life?
So the making money isn't what's important. You know, the funny thing with having money of a certain level is if that is what drives you, you'll never have enough. So you can go and stay in a 5-star hotel, but there's a 6-star hotel. You can arrive by boat, but someone's just arrived by helicopter. You can fly club class, but there's other people flying first class. And then you're in first class, there's people that are flying private jet. So if money is your happiness, you're never going to be happy because there is always a step above. What we wanted, and I think I can talk for Andrew in this as well, was financial freedom. So it wasn't the things we could buy, but it was the not having to worry about money, to do what we wanted, provide for our family, live a very lovely lifestyle in a non-lavish way. And that is enough for us from a money point of view. So the next phases of, I think, our journey is more about growing businesses, whether that be ours again or investing in others and helping grow other businesses. But the satisfaction and the excitement of actual growing a business, I think that's It sounds a bit sad, but I think that's what I found was part of my core happiness was the hustle and bustle of business. Like, that is actually what I love. And that's what I get a lot of joy out of. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that's sort of why the direction we're going in now is around all of that.
Well, great. Well, look, that's a great segue to talk about Horseplay Ventures, which is kind of your next chapter, Nick. So tell us a bit about it. Like, what is it? And when did you start it?
The Horseplay, so the name comes about because it's just about horsing around. So fun, like startup ecosystem is fun and everyone takes themselves a bit too seriously nowadays, especially in the entrepreneurial founder world. So we sort of just want to remind everyone that it's meant to be a bit fun as well. And first and foremost, it's our angel investing arm. So we invest under Horseplay. It's Andrew and I's personal cash. So we're not a VC, but we wanted to be one of the first angel investors to actually have a brand around them as well, because most angel investors are just their own self. So yeah, we built Horseplay, which is our angel investment arm. We invest in about 38 companies at the moment in the UK and the US. And we're very hands-on. So it's all about the founders. So when we invest, we tell the founders that we're there for them. You know, we want to help. We don't just want to receive the monthly email and be done with it. You know, any problems you have, whether it be about your office or your emotional state or the business, just, you know, let us know. We've literally just been through it. So we're very hands-on angel investors. We're also launching out of Horseplay a startup studio, which is a very American model, which I think is going to come here in a big way, which is basically exited founders that have some cash to be able to build out their own ideas that they have, but then not run them. So the idea is we have an idea, we validate it, we build it, we get it to market, we do the strategy, and then we actually bring in a founder with serious equity to actually run the business after, say, 6 or 8 months. And Andrew and I would be on the board and be very much in the background, but we wouldn't be in the office. We wouldn't, you know, the employees wouldn't really know us day to day. And then the idea is that you spin out one or two or three companies a year, and then have a portfolio of companies that you've created but aren't running day to day. So we've got our first idea that we're working on at the moment, which, if all goes to plan, we'll spin out probably midsummer. And that will be the first one out of our studio to sort of test this model. And then the final part of Horseplay is helping founders. So on our Horseplay website, we've got lots of free startup tools that you can just download. We don't even ask for your data. So there's like example pitch decks and P&Ls and revenue charts and podcasts we love. So all of that, you can just go on and download. And then I also do a podcast myself called Pitch Deck, which is like a Dragon's Den style audio, where a seed founder will pitch to myself and a guest angel. And it's really cool because we sort of lift the lid on angel investing. So obviously Dragon's Den is very sensationalized, and it's a TV show, which I think a lot of people don't actually realize. So, you know, we show, you know, the founder pitches to us, and then we do a live Q&A with the founder, as we would if we were in an angel meeting. So other founders get to really hear how an angel will critique a pitch. And then the angel and myself discuss that pitch without the founder there. So it's just a really good way to lift the lid on, you know, how you should pitch angels and what angels are looking for.
So do you think the new generation of founders is inclusive enough? And if not, what can we do to make it more so?
No, this is a very sort of personal question to me, and it's something I try and raise on LinkedIn, which is sort of my main platform. Being gay myself, I very rarely saw sort of gay representation in the founder world or in leaders of big companies. You know, I think Apple is probably the only one that I can think that comes to mind still. And sure, that makes you doubt yourself. And I know, you know, personally, when I was running Design My Night, I was never sort of in the closet, let's say, in the office. So everyone knew what, you know, who I was. I was very open about it, lots of fun about that. We try to hire very inclusively as well. You know, when you were going to meet, or when I was going to meetings, you know, especially with maybe older, you know, straight white males who run big sort of breweries, let's say, I would project my own thoughts onto them of how I thought they would think of me, which is totally wrong. Like, none of them ever said anything to make me think that. So I would definitely sort of hide that side of me when speaking to clients, and would never banter about my personal life. But also, as a society, it's important for us just to be more aware. So, you know, the first question, if someone talks about your personal life to me, would be like, oh, have you got a wife? Have you got a girlfriend? And, you know, that already puts you on the back foot. So I think as a society, we've got a lot to do to not just cast people into these boxes that we're so good at putting people in straight away. And from a founder, and now I'm an investor, which is an even more white, middle, upper class world, older gentleman world. So I think there is a lot to do. I think there's, I want to sort of give a voice to the sort of LGBT plus community that you can be a founder and it's great. And I would argue probably more suited to be a founder because of different sensitivities that, that you might have versus, you know, a straight white male. But then there's also the same battles with men and women. You know, women are very under, I think it's something like 2% of women founded companies get funding. And then it's the same with black and minority group founders as well, and investors. So I think there's a lot of work for us to do. And that is starting. I'm seeing, you know, lots of groups that want to lift up LGBT people, you know, black and ethnic minorities and women founders. And I think we're getting there. I think as a society, we're slowly getting there. But that's definitely part of something that I want to do, is I can only talk about the minority that I am. So I sort of want to give a voice to founders of the community that I'm part of.
I fully expect you get this a lot, but being asked to be a mentor, I assume that comes up for you. So kind of how do you decide who to say yes and no to, if you're happy to share like some of those stories, kind of how do you make that those decisions?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I get asked a lot, and I hate saying no to people, but that's a skill that I've learned, which is also very important, is to say no to people, because you then give over all of your time to other people, and then you never actually have time to yourself. The decision I actually made was to join groups. So I'm a mentor at Virgin Startup. I'm a mentor at London and Partners, which is the London Mayor's scheme. I'm a mentor at Homegrown Club. So rather than just picking off people randomly, I've done it officially, and give myself over to say two or three founders a quarter within those groups. However, you know, what I genuinely try and do is if someone messages me and wants my advice or a quick call, which is never quick. So, you know, what I do say is, look, I'm not taking sort of cold calls, unfortunately. I haven't got space to officially mentor you, because if I am, I'd want to do it properly. You know, why don't you ask me, like, email me over two burning questions that you think I can help with, and I will definitely take the time to reply to that. So it's a balance of being an official mentor, which I take very seriously, and just, you know, giving someone hopefully one or two nuggets of information that that might help them on their journey.
You've achieved quite a lot, Nick. And as you've said yourself, you're still relatively young. I can see that. We're on Zoom. But what is there on your professional and personal bucket list?
So I think professional is, Andrew, my co-founder, and I are really excited about this startup model. And I think in the next sort of 10 years, we want to have a, you know, a real portfolio of 10 to 20 companies, you know, like Design My Night, that we're not actually running, but that are successful, and maybe exiting, maybe not, and bringing in founders and helping them grow within our own companies. I think that really, really excites us. So that's probably our main goal from a business perspective, and do we have the nous and the wit and the knowledge to keep coming up with these ideas that are successful? You know, you've got your second album syndrome. I think just because we've been a successful founder once, it doesn't guarantee that all the other ones we're going to do as successful. We've learned a lot, but that's still not enough. So I think that's really exciting for us. And yeah, from a personal point of view, it's, yeah, I think, as I said, being more present in sort of lifting up the LGBT plus community that I'm part of. It's not something I've spoken out about a lot before when I was at Design My Night. So I really want to sort of become more of a voice for that community within the startup world. Also want to work more with kids. So I'm a big Spurs fan for my sins. And they have their Tottenham Hotspur charity, which is about helping the underprivileged kids in the Tottenham area, which, you know, isn't all the nicest area of London, unfortunately. And I've spoken to them about putting in maybe like a startup program, which they haven't done yet. And helping kids that just haven't got an opportunity and weren't as lucky as I were to come up with ideas and start a business. You know, you don't have to have money and be white and middle class to start a business, but that definitely helps, unfortunately. So I want to sort of lift up those people as well. So yeah, it's more, definitely don't want to say the cliche giving back, because I'll get a lot out of it as well, but I'm just very passionate about the startup space and helping kids, because I think that is where the future is going to be. It's the startups that are changing the world. It's the startups that are solving the ecological crisis we've got. It's startups that are solving inequality. So if I can be as much part of that community as possible, then, you know, I think I'll be very fulfilled.
We are nearly there. And there's one final question for you, Nick, which is our signature question, which is asking you about your favorite TV ad. So we'll ask you what your favorite TV ad is and why, and as it's an audio medium, if you can do your best to describe the ad, although knowing what's coming, I think most will know.
So I'm going to break the rules. I've got two, but they're both very different. So one I would say might be a bit more cliche, but I love it. And one hopefully no one's ever said on this podcast before. So I'm going to start with the outlier, which was the launch of Adele's new album, 25, during the X Factor slot, when X Factor used to be popular. And the first song off the album was Hello, and the lyric was Hello, it's me. And all they did was just show up Adele's face on a black screen with her singing Hello, it's me, which was the start of the first single. And that was it. No Adele, no 25. And within a second, she was trending globally on Twitter. And, you know, what a way to launch a new album. It just shows the power of her. But just the lyrics itself, which were like, hello, like I'm back, kind of thing, I thought was absolutely genius. And I mean, her album was always going to be successful, but just a, you know, really innovative, smart way. And I also saw that as a bit of nod to herself, knowing how popular she is. And why not be a bit cocky? Like, she doesn't come across like that at all, but she is an absolute megastar, and seems very nice with it. So why not, you know, have a little bit of fun with it? So I won't sing it for you, but that was, I absolutely love that. And that's always stuck in my head. The more cliche one, but it's an advert I've just always, always loved, is the surfer from Guinness, which the listeners might know if I say tick follows tock follows tick follows tock, which was the surfer in Hawaii, all about catching the perfect wave. And obviously the Guinness good thing comes to those who wait, which is obviously to do with the Guinness pour and how long it takes.
Here's to waiting.
Actually reading into the advert more, you know, they found local surfers that they took ages to find, that the actual surfing was all done real time, waiting for that big wave with cameras strapped to them, and other cameramen like risking their lives filming that as well alongside them. And then obviously they added in the CGI of the horses galloping along with the waves, and then it all crashes down, and that's what a perfect Guinness looks like, with its black belly and its foamy top. So I just think it captures everything that they're about, in a very sort of cinema, what's the word? Cinematographic, you'll know, cinematographic way, very iconic. And I love Guinness anyway, but those two for me are the standouts.
Yeah, I think cinematic is probably the right word for it. And no surprise, therefore, that the progenitor of that ad, Jonathan Glazer, went on to be and continues to be quite a prodigious director in Hollywood. We've mentioned it before. I don't think anybody's chosen this ad before, but we have had Jonathan mentioned quite a few times. It's from March 1999. Abbott Mead Vickers were and still are, you know, the legendary creative powerhouse behind Guinness. Now, I have done a bit of research and I love it. Apparently, the imagery may potentially, allegedly, be from a 19th century British pre-Raphaelite artist and illustrator. You can tell I'm not making this up, called Walter Crane. Go and Google his painting called Neptune's Horses, and you'll be very surprised what you see. And in terms of the copy, I think it is probably a little bit better known that they're paying homage to Herman Melville's Moby Dick in the copy there. So a visual homage and a written homage. But as always, Nick, you've picked something that has an amazing piece of music to go with it. And at Wax On, we often talk about the power of music in making very, very distinctive advertising. And in that case, it's Left Field's Fat Planet, which lives on in our ears when the ad has finished. So an amazing choice. Thank you for that.
Well, look, Nick, thank you so much for joining us. That's taken us to the end. It's been a brilliant chat, very enjoyable, very interesting. I think not often we get a guest where, like, I would have thought all, if not the majority of our listeners, has engaged with the brand that made you famous. So that would be great for everyone that tunes in. So thanks for your time. I look forward to catching up with you again soon. And take care.
And best of luck.
Thank you so much, really.
And best of luck as a Spurs supporter as well.
Yeah, we'll gloss over that. I don't know why I mentioned that.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.